15 to 20 million.
Jump down.
I am your future.
Isn't it about time for a change?
We're our national leader.
AmericanWorkersRadio.com.
You're listening to American Workers Radio, a national network promoting American-made products with your host, Michael Blihash.
Well, welcome once again to another edition of American Workers Radio here on 860 AM Radio, which, as you know, serves southeastern Pennsylvania, the state of New Jersey, and Northern Delaware. And if you live in our broadcast range, contact family and friends and invite them to tune in to the broadcast. And then, of course, we're going to definitely, without having a second thought, have a great broadcast today. If you received our email this morning, send it out to family and friends because it's going to be a doozy today. We have open forum, and I'm just going to make a few comments to make sure that we stay on our message, and then the floodgates of whatever has to be said can be said, and I want to hear it without any interruption. First of all, I'd like to say thank you to Mark Andel. You know him as the founder of the Made in America store, a man always on the go doing his best. And I ask you to do your best to promote his store, which is right there posted on the front page of AmericanWorkersRadio.com. Then we have Larkin Conley, a small business advocate, always there trying to look at the news, decipher what's really happening. And I hope that he watched some of the debate yesterday. We'll talk a little bit about that as well. Rich Logis, the principal of RJL Technology Integration, the man with many facts and figures, always ready to speak up. And of course, Curtis Ellis. And I'll tell you, Curtis, the American First Project is very important. And I'd like you to talk today about the China deal so the people understand it a little better. And I want to say thank you also to our engineer, Henry Chaplinsky. I'm Michael Blihash, and I'm very pleased to be with you. It's going to be a great election season. We're not that far away. And the main reason I'm concerned is because I'm looking out for American workers. With so many good things happening in the world of business, especially in America, we see that it's more important than ever to support American workers. And that's the goal that we've been benefiting from. And after many years of listening to all this stuff going on in political circles and in Washington, no one has really kept their finger on the pulse of American workers the way we did. In the United States, we certainly have the people and, of course, the ability to ensure that the United States is the international focal point, not just the place known for freedom, peace, and justice, but the nation where businesses, American workers, and the American people have the opportunity to be the best that they can be and always be there to invent as well as produce the products that are used by Americans so often. There, for many years, we had invention after invention. The next thing you know, those inventions were transferred to foreign countries, and here we are. Our people have less jobs, and people all over the world have more jobs. Supporters of the Buy American campaign are really seeing for themselves what can happen and how America can flourish if we stick together the way we have in the last few years and make sure that we don't fall again. I feel especially American workers are asking themselves, am I better off than I was before? Am I better off in the last 2 or 3 years? That's what the question is everywhere I go. Whether I stop at a job fair, whether I talk to some of the job providers, that's the big question. Am I better off today than I was 2 or 3 years ago? Does it look like we're going to have a future? And we have to be very honest. There are many concerns that we have, and that is the lack of some skills in the United States. Automation is taking a lot of jobs. And of course, if we had the skills, even with automation, and we continue to promote all those jobs that we sent out of America, bring them back to America, boy, we are going to be in tip-top shape. I really feel, after watching the debates, after talking to the people, there's going to be a report card on Election Day in November. With that, today I'm going to open up our panel questions and hear from them. I'm going to go to Curtis Ellis. Curtis, how are you doing? Tell us everything that's new and give us a little hint about what's happened with this China deal.
Well, in about 25 minutes from now, China's vice premier will be in the White House signing a trade deal, the so-called Phase One trade deal with the Trump administration. And I won't go into the details of the numbers and facts and figures. Basically, what's in the deal, China has agreed to purchase some more goods and services from America, and because we know that whatever China agrees to, the devil is in the details. They say you begin negotiations after you sign a deal with China. So we'll see. But what's most important is there's two important things to remember. One, it is up to us in this deal. It is up to us and us alone to determine if China is living up to the agreement. It is not a high-level discussion where we have to get consensus and get the Chinese to agree that they're doing something wrong. We can unilaterally reimpose tariffs on China if we determine unilaterally that they're not living up to the agreement. But what I say in my column at American Greatness website, the American Greatness site, I say in my column, the most important thing about this deal is the deal itself, the fact that President Trump has reset our relations with China, the fact that President Trump has remade the debate on trade and the economy. Prior to President Trump coming on the scene, most people thought we had a trade deal with China. We certainly did have trade with China. And to the extent they thought about it, too many people, in fact, thought that it was just fine the way it was. But and you even saw all the politicians felt that way, and the media felt that way, and you still see remnants of that in the coverage that you see, that that America was inevitably and inextricably intertwined with China. Our economies were intertwined, something called Chimerica. They even had a name for it. We didn't live in America anymore. We now lived and worked in Chimerica. And this was a symbiotic relationship between the United States and China, and this is the way it would be till the end of history. Well, symbiotic, if you look up the word, symbiosis means a mutually advantageous relationship. And I tell you, everybody listening here, and Michael and Mark and everyone else, and understands that that this relationship has been anything but mutually advantageous. We've lost 2.7 million jobs. We have lost 55,000 factories. America's incomes have sunk, and many American lives have sunk into despair. We've seen our standard of living decline. We've seen our life expectancy decline. We've seen suicide overdose and alcoholism rates skyrocket as concurrent with the loss of jobs and opportunities for Americans. So this has not been a symbiotic relationship with China, and President Trump is the first person to come on the scene in a generation to say so. And then, further, more than just say so, he's actually done something about it. And rather than accepting some textbook theory about tariffs and trade and comparative advantage and some other nonsense, he actually looks at the real world and says, this isn't going to work. I'm going to rearrange the furniture here, and I'm going to reset these relations. And he put tariffs in place, and he got China to come to the table. And as a result of this deal, the tariffs still remain in place. And you're going to hear over the next several weeks and months a bunch of whining and moaning about how, well, you know, there's still 25% tariffs on $250 billion worth of goods coming in from China. I say, hooray, they should be 50% tariffs, maybe 100% tariffs. It's about time we bring the productivity back to the United States. It's time we bring productive assets back to the United States. If you were a Master of Business Administration major and you put forward a business plan that said, I'm going to start a business and I am going to be dependent on one supplier for all of my inputs, for all of the products, for everything that I need to make my business run, I will be entirely 100% dependent on one supplier for that, you'd get kicked out of school. You'd get an F. You would fail. You wouldn't get your Master of Business Administration degree. You'd get shown the door. Yet that is exactly what the business leaders of this country and the political leaders of this country have done to our nation. We are entirely dependent on China, on communist China, for our pharmaceuticals, for our drugs, even for our defense capabilities. A lot of the high-tech components that go into our missiles and our fighter jets are sourced from China. All of our electronics, sourced from East Asia, if not from China itself, from countries that are basically under the thumb of China. How is this a good idea? How did we let this happen? Well, I won't answer that question. We all know how it happened. Somebody was out to make a fast buck. And what has happened is we have replaced the historical norm that built this country into the most prosperous, broad-based, middle-class country on earth. It was a high-wage, high-productivity model. We would have higher wages in America. And in order to be able to pay people higher wages, workers would be more productive. They would have better tools, better equipment that would boost their productivity. So one worker could produce more than 10 coolies on the other side of the earth. That was the model that made America great. High wages, high productivity. And as people had higher wages, they had more money to spend, and they could buy the things they made.
And how long did that last, Curtis?
That lasted until approximately 1975. That lasted well into the 20th century. It started to get eroded in the 1970s. It actually started to get eroded in the 1960s. We could already see it with the textile industry. What replaced it was a low-wage, low-productivity model. And this is, to put it in plain English, when you hear people say, well, we get cheap goods from overseas. Free trade is good. Our trade relations are good because we're getting cheap stuff from China.
Right.
Well, what they're basically saying is we're going to use cheap labor to produce goods that are then sold in the United States.
As if they were American-made products.
Exactly.
I love to go and do my research in the stores, and when I start asking them questions. So, Curtis, let me just ask you the question. So, as far as you know, there has not been a trade agreement with China in the last 40 years.
Not really, no. Well, in 20 years ago, what happened is we gave China what's called most favored nation status. We decided we would treat China the same way we treat Great Britain or France or Norway or Sweden, the industrial democracies of the world, our traditional trading partners, places that respect human rights and allow people to ask for higher wages, other high-wage, high-productivity nations. We decided we were going to treat China the same way. They had been, prior to that, they were subject to an annual review of their human rights record. If they were locking up prisoners, harvesting their organs, forcing women to have abortions, all the things they're doing today, if they didn't show improvement in this area, we would be able to put high tariffs on their imports. Well, we changed that 20 years ago. That was an official act of Congress, spearheaded by President Bill Clinton, the head of the Foreign Relations Committee, and the ranking member, Joe Biden, They all agreed that we should do this. It would be great. It would make China into our friend. So that was the last move that was made per trade with China. It was not called a trade deal, but it was. It was called permanent normal trade relations with China. If anybody who was unlucky enough to listen to the Democratic debate last night, you may have heard, if you stayed awake through it, you would have heard Bernie Sanders talk about PNTR with China. PNTR stands for permanent normal trade relations. U.S. Congress granted China permanent normal trade relations in 2000. That was our last trade agreement with China until President Trump came along and reset the table. He rearranged the furniture. And now we have a different understanding that China is not our friend. They're not becoming more democratic. They're not becoming more free market. And we should not be taking them at their word for what they're saying they're doing.
You know, Curtis, I believe that President Trump has done more than people realize. The national media has done nothing but try to condemn what's going on, which means they're also condemning our types of programs, the Buy American Made campaign, because they want those dollars coming in bushel baskets from overseas. They know that they can buy a product for a dollar, bring it in, and sell it to the American people for $10. I'm very glad, and I'd like to see this not only with China, but all the other trading partners that America has, because I'd like to see a lot of those industries recreated. Some of them are being recreated here in the United States of America. We have to grow our own. That's the bottom line.
Exactly. We have to make it here. We used to. President Trump and his generation remembers what it was like to have a high wage, high productivity economy where Americans made the things that we bought. We had the money to afford to buy the things we made. And all of this falderal that the Democrats talk about, income inequality, and even when they talk about climate change, every problem the Democrats are talking about in their debate and in their propaganda operation all comes back to the one thing they don't talk about, China's role in the world economy. When we outsourced our jobs to China, we cut the incomes of Americans and created this huge disparity of income inequality. Not going to be solved by some giveaway programs that the Democrats are proposing. It's going to be solved by bringing jobs back to America, right, so Americans are working.
And Curtis, it's not going to be solved overnight. But once you put the train on the track, you can't stop it from going. We have to keep that train on the track. And I'm not saying also this. Some people say, oh, you're strictly for President Trump. I said, no. I'm for any president. I would be for Clinton, for Bush, for Obama, for Trump. Any person who's doing what's happening in this country right now is the man I want in the White House. It could have been Barack Obama. He certainly had the opportunity to do that. Who stopped him? George Bush had the opportunity to do the same thing. Who stopped him? How about Bill Clinton? He was living in the world of the new technology with the computerization and all. Why didn't he say, well, this is only one part. How about we start doing additional things? How about we start going after our schools to get these skilled programs back, to let the people in America know exactly what type of jobs the people are going to need in businesses 5 years, 10 years, 15 years down the road. When I go to some of these job fairs and I talk to these young people, they went to school, they paid the big money, and a lot of the stuff they have walking around from their pocketbooks, school bags, which the backpacks that they wear, the computers, cell phones and all, nothing is made in America. How is that possible? How did it get to that point?
It's shameful. It was deliberate decisions that were made. Deliberate decisions that were made at the highest levels of industry, of finance, and politics. They said, we're going to move from a high-wage, high-productivity economy to a low-wage model. I mean, this is, it's not free trade. It's labor arbitrage. We're going to find the cheapest labor on earth, and we're going to make it there and sell it. It's buy low, sell high. We're going to find the cheapest labor to make it, and then we're going to bring it into the greatest, strongest consumer market in the world, that's the United States, and sell it for a high price.
You know, Curtis, from what I'm seeing, that consumer market has had its day. Because
that's right.
A lot of those people, in continuing to buy products, they cut down on a lot of their savings. Their income started not to meet the demands of what they had to buy. And then when they were unemployed or had to go to part-time jobs, this killed American workers, American families. Communities were devastated. People turned to all sorts of drugs and everything else because they were disgusted with their own background, what was going on around them. A person who has a child wants to be able to support that child, not to be told,
that's
well,
right,
the jobs that I could have had are now located in some foreign country. This is totally objectionable. I'm glad the president is speaking up. I could care less about all the rigmarole that's going on. I'm only concerned about what are we doing for our future and what are we doing for our people today, because my children and grandchildren deserve to have the America that the people in America had 25 and 30 years ago. Let me turn for a moment to Mark Andel. Mark, how are you doing, Guy?
Good, excellent. How are you, Mike?
Well, you're hearing the discussion of the day. It's open forum. Throw the turkey on the table so we can cut it up.
Good. Welcome all guys, Rick and Larkin. But Curtis, your point on, I read your article, the most important thing about a trade deal is the deal itself. And just hats off to you, even your conversation today. That's what it's all about. Again, my first shirt, because China's a long drive to work, you know, and we're coming up on our 10-year anniversary with the Made in America store. But China is the factory of the world, and we're the consumer of the world, like you said. And, you know, Trump's the only one that had the backbone to really open it up. And I always said, if, you know, you want to grow the country, tax the imports. And that's what's happening. So I think that's an awesome article. It's point on, we should discuss this further and further, because that's what happened to America. The middle class was shrinking to, you know, to nothing, and blue-collar workers, high wage, high productivity. Nucor had that idea. You know, you hire, you know, five, work them like 10, pay them like 8, but you always kept that quality high. And disposable income is what it for. You know, they made better wages, had that disposable income, and could buy the products they made and produced, and it was a quality product. So, Mike, a lot going on. You know, we had a great fourth quarter with Made in America and General Welding. You know, I support the president. Again, I'd be out of business without Donald Trump, without my military work, mining work, and where we are today. And that's a fact, and I'm telling people that more and more as we get closer to this election, because it's so important to keep this work here.
You know, Mark, I've been watching a few of the debates. I can't watch the entire 3 hours. I don't have the time to do that. But from what I'm seeing, good people on the panel and everyone listening, the presidential debates are pretty valuable because they're letting people who are the candidates know what they're really all about. The voters sitting there watching the shows, however many there are learning a little bit about what's really on their minds, and then they're hearing the other side of how we need to promote jobs, how we have to make sure our industries grow, how our inventions grow, how our inventions are made in America, because this is something we shouldn't sell overseas. I know I'm very happy to watch a little bit of the debates. And the biggest question I have, and I'm going to ask each panel member, starting with you, Mark, which person on the most recent presidential debates impressed you the most as the person best ready to advance the cause of American workers and also be a great commander-in-chief? Mark?
You know, I don't see one up there that, you know, again, Donald Trump was a businessman. I was after that. You know, we talked about, you know, that's the problem I see, Mike. I'm not impressed with all of them, even Bernie, and listening to the you know, socialism and different things. I'd rather see the factual board up what Donald Trump has accomplished and see somebody wanting to carry that out and further it and carry that torch. And I don't see that right now, so I don't really want to answer that. There's not one I can choose.
Okay. All right. Rich Logis, we need to know which person you're most impressed with,
well,
that you feel you'd
go.
Be a great commander-in-chief.
Well, good morning to everybody. Curtis, I'm going to run with the Brewster's Millions answer, none of the above. Michael, I'm going Richard Pryor on this one. Brewster's Millions. And I want to just give a shout-out to Curtis's article that appeared at American Greatness today, amgreatness.com. And I've learned a lot, Curtis. You know, I've learned a lot about international trade from you being on this show. I think our listeners have. Thank you. And when I've read about the trade deficit, Michael, we've had, you know, our deficit is over $500 billion, and two-thirds of that is China. And me and Larkin last week after the show were talking about President Reagan's style of statesmanship and diplomacy. And if you guys all recall, President Reagan had utilized a Russian proverb when talking about his dealings with denuclearization with the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics, which was trust but verify. And that's a pretty smart strategy, Curtis, I think. Now, granted, this is economic compared to military back in the day, but I think, Curtis, that that principle is exactly what has been utilized here. Trust but verify. And everybody has to earn, Michael, all the parties who are going to engage in a deal, there needs to be some good faith trust up front, like there has been, but then everybody has to continually have to earn their trust to keep this going. So what Curtis has presented here, and it's also why I've mentioned about tariffs, Michael, and Mark just mentioned this. In the past, I admittedly didn't know a hell of a lot about tariffs. I've come to learn a lot about them. And I've come to determine that while no solution is a perfect answer or solution, Michael, tariffs make sense right now. And I think for if you want a singularly good reason, all of our economic gains in the last 36 months have lower taxes, produced higher median incomes, more money in our paychecks. No tariffs means that China is just going to reap the financial benefits of our strong economy. And why should, Curtis, China reap the most benefits of our strong economy? Why should they? They shouldn't. So between tariffs and this trade deal, Michael, this is the right pathway, I see it.
You know, Rich, I'm going to ask you a question. I'm going to turn to Larkin for a minute. Larkin, can you please tell us who began this process of selling America down the river by allowing all these industries to leave this country? You're a man who reads and watches the various programs for some years. Who started this avalanche?
Well, good morning, Michael and Curtis and Rich and Mark and to our beloved Henry. That's so important vote. I beat Rich to it. Yeah. You know, Michael, when you take a look at issues like that, there is a proactive criminal here and a reactive criminal. The proactive criminal was Walmart, was Costco, was a handful of importers who found a Tinker Toy with two wheels and a stick on it that a two-year-old could push, that was made in this country for $4 and would last a generation or two, and they found that same toy in China that would last 100 yards, maybe. So they're the proactive guilty party here. The reactive, it was the politicians who accepted the money, who accepted the lobbying efforts of everybody and did nothing to stop the tide. So we had a buying public who wanted things cheap, and we've already displaced that argument. They were paying $10 for that Tinker toy, whether it was made in China or made in America. But in order to introduce Chinese, Indonesian, Philippine, Indian products over here, they sold them cheap. We all know that. Might not be the case now. So that's what you got, two guilty parties and an American public that was more interested in price points than they were for their neighbor's job.
Well, you know, Larkin, what you're saying is that means a number of presidents, a number of House and Senate elected officials watched this happen and did nothing.
That's right. There's no question. There was nothing actively done in order to stop the tide. It started, as Curtis said, and he's 100% right, mid-70s, as the factory 50 started to close, as the steel mills started to close. I mean, my brother worked, I just remember being in college, and he was in college too, but he worked in the steel mill while he was in school. And I remember being so jealous of the amount of money that this kid was making working in the number two furnace at the Homestead Steelworks outside of Pittsburgh. I mean, it was, I said, well, why wouldn't you just drop out of college and do that? Well, the fact of the matter is that job disappeared. And the Homestead Steelworks, owned by United States Steel, which covered 15 to 25 acres and produced so much steel, is now a mall. And nobody anywhere stopped it. The unions blamed the owners blamed the unions, and they let it go away to produce cheap steel that then Mark had to put up with when they brought it over here.
So Larkin, what you're saying, whatever happened to that Pittsburgh plant, the steel plant, where did that move?
It's a mall. It's a mall.
But where did the plant move?
Never moved. It closed.
But somebody picked up the slack to make that steel. Did it go to Bethlehem Steel? Did it go to China? Where did it go?
To China.
That's the point.
Sure.
Everything was leaving. Jobs were going. The tax base was slowly going down the drain. And America's debt clock continued to rise to where we're over $23 trillion in debt right now. Did that make any sense?
It's the political answer. It's the political answer that we've faced for the last, since the Industrial Revolution. If we have to go through some paradigm, just throw money at it. Just throw money at those union workers. Just throw money at this. Just throw money at that. That's the easy and quick answer. And now, today, officially today, Michael, and you can go on your clock, officially today we crossed the $23 trillion debt mark.
Yes.
This morning. $23 trillion we owe the rest of the world.
And I invite everyone to look at the U.S. debt clock. It is right there on the front page of AmericanWorkersRadio.com. And you're right, Larkin. The national debt is now $23,187,000,000,000, which means, if you look right there, it tells you every citizen in America owes $70,000. If a baby is born 5 minutes from now, that child is saddled with a $70,000 debt. That doesn't make any kind of sense. And yet, this is a debt clock put out by the Census Bureau and the United States government. So that means the people in Washington are not looking out to the internet or have their people looking on the internet to tell them what's going on. The people are debating all kinds of things. We're going to give this away. We're going to give that away. Where do they expect money to come from? Money does not come through diapers. An unfortunate situation. Now, Larkin, I want to ask you the big question. Of all the people that are on the stage left, Which one would you feel would be a great commander-in-chief for America?
Well, I don't know if the world is great, if the word is great, but I don't mind Amy Klobuchar. She's a moderate, a little left of middle. I think she's a great thinker. I don't think that anybody tells her where to be or when to be there. And I like Amy Klobuchar. If I have to vote for some, I mean, if the Republicans fail to put anybody up, I think I would vote for Amy Klobuchar. She is, as fact would have it, probably the only one on the stage I would vote for. But let me tell you very quickly, this will take me 2 minutes, about last night in my household. My wife, Jody, and I go through a ritual every night where we sit down at 6 o'clock with a glass of nectar of the gods, usually red, and we clink glasses and we watch the local news to make sure that we still we're not in an anarchy. We watch the news, and my wife laughs at me as I throw stuff at the TV. And then we settle in, we eat dinner and settle into what is going to be an evening, although a brief evening of watching television to see what's on. Last night was really an interesting evening. Our first choices, we sat down and burrowed into those chairs. I of course, had the channel changer because it's a right-handed channel changer, and my wife is left-handed, so she can't have the channel changer. So we settled in, and we had two choices. We looked at each other and said, well, let's think about this. Our first choice was Jeopardy, the GOAT tournament, greatest of all time. And then our second choice was the last debate among the Democrats before the Iowa caucus. Now, I don't think anybody has to guess real hard as to which one I watched, but it was obviously the GOAT tournament. It was Jeopardy, where the contestants are rewarded for knowing facts and for having knowledge. And I wasn't ready for the antithesis of that on the other side of the television. So, and kudos to the guy from Philadelphia who appeared on the stage as the third contestant. His name escapes me. And I can't even tell you which part of Philadelphia he's from, but he's a Philadelphian, and he did well. I mean, you're talking about three contestants that never missed a question, and I didn't even understand the questions. Next, we had a choice between the Americans and then the continuation of the Democratic debate. The Americans is a series that's going on in prime television about Russian spies in America. And in this series, the Russians are stealing from us. In the particular episode we were in, they're stealing our stealth plans for anti-radar airplanes. We looked at each other, and we got the debates on the other hand. Needless to say, we picked the program where the Russians were the bad guys, the Americans were the good guys, and as fate would have it, the Americans usually won. You know, you don't have to watch the debate among Democrats to know, you know, what they're going to say. They promote the government. You know, they promote what government can do for you, and not for what you can do for yourself. It's a sophisticated form of bribery, is what I call it, on the Democratic part. Vote for me, and I'll give you more stuff.
Right.
Vote for me, health care for all. Never mind that you should have a sense of responsibility and making a life for yourself. Never mind that you should take advantage of capitalism and democracy. Let's all just depend on the government. It is called democratic bribery. More stuff. And more stuff.
You're
without
right.
Any treatment. And one more time last night, I have no idea because I didn't watch, but I'm betting money, not one person said the two words together, national debt.
No one. that I saw. I only watched 1 hour. I did watch so that I could, you know, understand what's going on. And it was interesting, but I said to myself, which of these people is going to be the person in the final debates before the November election? Which of these six people? And by the way, which of the six people will the people in the primaries think that this person would make the best commander in chief? With that, I want to turn to Curtis with the question. Curtis, what did you think of the debate yesterday? Did you have a chance to watch the entire episode?
Oh, I really tried to watch it. I did watch it. I got three quarters of the way through it. I after around 10:20, 10:30, my ears started to bleed, and so did my eyes, and I just couldn't take it anymore. It was interesting. I found the most authentic person on stage to be Bernie. Bernie Sanders, he, crazy as he is and as wrong-headed as he is on most things, he at least has the small virtue of consistency about him. Pete Buttigieg I found to be let's just say it. I'll say it out front. He is cut from the Obama cloth, right? Obama was the first black president. He wants to be the first gay president. He's a corporatist. He has nothing new to offer. He's the same old, same old. He's the old wine in new bottle. We're supposed to vote for him because he's different. He's gay, but he's no different. He's the same corporate model, corporate governance model that we've seen in the Democratic Party since Bill Clinton, if not before. So if you listen to what he says, he sounds so high-minded, but if you listen to what he's saying nothing, right? Amy Klobuchar, I just found, and I'm not trying to be mean about superficial things, but most people's decisions on politics are made on an emotional level. And then they're rationalized according to, well, I like their policy statement or this or that. So Amy Klobuchar, somebody needs to tell her that she can never become president because she has an annoying voice. Her voice is unlistenable. You cannot listen to that voice. Close your eyes and listen to the voice. I find it hard to hear what she's saying because she's so difficult to listen to. And people I know who work in the Senate, says she has a horrible reputation of being just impossible to work with, just a screamer and abusive to her staff. But that's, you know, that doesn't matter. Look, I've worked for abusive bosses and I've learned a lot from them, so I don't care about that. Tom Steyer, I don't know what he's doing on stage there. He is, he's got beady little eyes that are disconcerting. He doesn't blink. He's another corporate, same old, same old. It's just amazing. And Elizabeth Warren, some of her economic policy when she talks about trade is good, but none of these people can allow themselves to acknowledge that President Trump has made great strides in resetting our trade relationship. They keep talking about Donald Trump's trade war. Not Donald Trump's trade war. China has been waging this trade war for 40 years. They refuse to acknowledge that. One of the and Joe Biden, they need to start. Sanders and Warren need to attack Joe Biden for being the corporate shill that he is. If they want to be true progressives, they call themselves progressives. They call themselves true liberals. Their war is against the corporate wing of the Democratic Party. That's who they should be attacking. Joe Biden is the incarnation of the corporate wing of the party. The fact that they won't attack him shows that they're frauds and cowards. Now, Warren said something interesting when she was asked about the healthcare stuff. And she was talking about how there's 36 million Americans who can't afford their prescriptions, right? They get prescriptions for something they need to treat something they have, and they have to make a choice between that prescription and groceries, between buying the medicine and buying groceries. And that struck me as like, oh, well, it hinted at a solution, because the other problem facing America is the obesity epidemic, right? There's an obesity epidemic. Too many people are way overweight in this country, and that leads to health complications. I say we give those 36 million prescriptions to the obese people. And that way, when they have to make a choice between the prescriptions and the groceries, they can buy the prescription because they don't need the groceries because they're overweight. So that'll solve that problem right there.
Wow, Curtis, that was great. The thing that I want to tell you that I was disappointed, the hour or so that I watched, there was very little focus on the American workers, on education, other than it give it away. You know, by the way, guys, every taxpayer contributes toward education. But how many of us here, what we're getting for the tax dollars that we're giving, whether it's local, state, or federal government? In the last 30 years, how many of the schools actually documented how they were going to address the needs of skilled workers, like skilled workers in carpentry, plumbing, heating, building and repairs, and infrastructure for the country, and even what's going to happen in the next 5, 10, 15 years with all the automation that's coming into the picture? No school talks about that. All they want you to do is come in, pay your money, sit in the seat, go home, either because your parents are paying the money, you have a loan out, or the school district is paying your money. When I talk to some of the teachers, they are very human about this. They're very concerned, but they don't make the rules and regs. The people that you saw on the stage yesterday are the people that are supposed to promote that. They're supposed to say, we are in a great need of plumbing and heating people. We need people that can repair, be carpenters, measure, invent, research and development for the things that we have in this country right now that need to be repaired, need to be totally revitalized, all the automation, all the infrastructure. Nobody's talking about that. It seems that they're talking all about things that don't affect us on a day-to-day basis. I want to tell you a little something that I had a conversation with a person about American workers who attacked me about the wall on the southern border. And the person said to me, you know, you talked about the wall a few weeks ago and a few months ago, and I don't understand why you are worried about that wall. I said, well, the wall stops people who don't have our permission to come to America. And they say, well, what does that have to do with me? I'm living here in Pennsylvania. I said, that's right. 99.9% of the American people are not affected by that wall. They're not there. They're not living in that area. However, the wall is protecting 99.9% of the American people that came here, that want to live here, that are paying taxes here, that don't want people coming here uninvited to be making more than $23 trillion in debt. And the person said, I better understand it. And those are the kinds of things I was hoping to hear from these candidates. Why are they so angry about a wall that's protecting our country, our people, and our livelihoods? I don't understand it. Rich, do you? You've been down that way. Do you understand why this big objection to the wall is out there?
Well, Larkin wants to say something, Michael. I'm going to defer to Larkin here.
Yeah, I just wanted to add something to what Curtis was saying. I have a reason to be in double-wide homes and in the lower economic rung on the ladder by virtue of a nonprofit that I work for and the court systems. I'm in them 3 and 4 days a week. And I've got to tell you something. The problem in these communities isn't the fact that they can't afford drugs. The problem is that they've completely got their priorities completely out of whack, totally out of whack. I'll pull up to a double wide that inside is barely barely livable. But when in the living room, there's always that corner that's got a 46-inch TV that gets every channel known to man. And the last woman told me she pays $205 a month for cable. And she's got a brand-new Ford Escape sitting out on the parking lot. And they can't afford drugs? Excuse me. Excuse me. Where are your priorities?
Well, see, these are the kinds
Michael,
of things.
Michael, can I add a
yes,
point,
Rich.
Please? And I say this all the time. It's in my book, 10 Warning Signs Your Child is Becoming a Democrat, How to Make America Grown Up Again. It's in there, Michael, which is that politics is about sales. Successful salespeople, I don't care your industry, they get their buying market, what their buying market wants and cares about, not what the salesman wants and cares about. What you and I wasn't watching the Democrat debate last night, Michael, so-called debate. I say so-called because everybody thinks identically like a cult. I wasn't listening to the debate because I was at an event and the gentleman I was with, Michael, we're going to have him on this show. He's coming to Philadelphia for a project. I'm going to show you guys what it is. It's great. It's a guy who goes around to big cities and picks up trash off the street. And he's coming to Philadelphia in April. I want to have him on the show. So more to be announced on that. When you listen to what the candidates on stage talk about Curtis, what they talk about is what, for example, people in Philadelphia want and what Chicago wants and what Detroit wants and what Newark wants. And what do you notice about all these cities, Michael? They've all been – so all these people in Philadelphia and Detroit and Newark, they already get all this because they've been electing Democrats for tens of thousands of consecutive days. So that's who wants on the stage. People in Oakland want it. The rest of the adult-thinking world in America doesn't actually want it. That's why we won an election with the majority of people in the majority of states, which is why I must very quickly as we close up here just – because I missed the last episode, I have to just let our great audio engineer know, Henry, a swing voter in a swing state in Pennsylvania. We're going to earn his vote. We're not going to take him for granted. The problem, we're going to work to get his vote. And when you really break it down, Michael, all of us deep down, whether we want to admit this or not, everywhere deep down, you know, we probably have a little hypocrisy here or there that we just engage in because the adult world is full of shades of gray, not black and white. The people on the stage last night, just like the prior ones, don't believe anything that comes out of their mouths. They are all affluent, well-to-do capitalist millionaires, Larkin. None of them believe any of the bull. Pete Buttigieg is the dumbest ever smart person. That's my nickname for him. And Warren, I mean, she's a Shakespearean level shrew. If Shakespeare were alive today with Curtis and he wrote The Taming of the Shrew, he wouldn't name the shrew Kate like in the play. He'd name her Liz. Bottom line. So that's the reality of these candidates.
But Rich, she could be the next commander-in-chief.
Well, she'll be the VP. Over a year ago, I predicted Biden. Warren, I'm sticking to that prediction. And if I'm wrong, I'm wrong. But I have a pretty good track record of predictions. And you know, the difference with, of course, President Trump, I mean, along the way, like any politician, whether he wants to admit that or not, sometimes you might actually have to compromise some of your own principles in order to give your market what they want. And that happens in sales. That's a normal, natural sales cycle. The reality is the people on the stage last night, Michael, they don't believe in socialism for themselves. They don't believe in progressivism for themselves. What they believe in is money, guns, fossil fuels, jets, and big bank accounts. The president doesn't shy away from that because he likes all that stuff also. So if you want authenticity, you're probably not going to get it, Curtis, at a Democrat debate.
Well, with that, I have to tell you, I'm urging everyone to go to the front page of AmericanWorkersRadio.com and you'll see the big link, Register to Vote. I will not tell you how to register. I'll just tell you that in order for you to vote in the primaries in most states that are not open primaries, you have to be a Democrat or a Republican. Register how you choose so that when the primaries come about, you're ready to go out there and make a choice of the people who are up there. The biggest thing that I see when I go around is I ask people, are you registered to vote? Majority of them are. Some just look at me and say, well, my vote doesn't really count. I hate to tell you, your vote does count.
2016, Michael, proved that your vote counts. If
your
anyone,
counts.
And our audio engineer, and not to speak for him, but I don't think he'll mind me saying this again, swing voter in a swing state. I remember on election night, our audio engineer, amongst others, saying to me, who thought that it was in the bag for Clinton, Pierre, I understand why they thought that. But he said, like others, it restored my faith a little bit more in the democratic process. And that was, honestly, Michael, just as encouraging as the win itself. No, it matters. Elections have consequences, and we do influence the outcome. And how it is exactly how the framers of this country wanted it, Michael, where everybody has a say in the final outcome.
My main concern is that everyone who's eligible to vote, every citizen of this great country, be out there to vote so that we know the real pulse of America. I want to see every city and state get 80, 90%, 100% of their voters out. I know that's a dream, but I'd like to at least invite them to be there on election day, because this is going to be a very interesting election. We've heard a lot of talk, a lot of this and that, but you have to be registered. And I encourage you, the Register to Vote link on our front page takes you to every state and every city. No matter where you are, you can use that particular panel to go. Just click on it, register to vote. Well, ladies and gentlemen, until this Saturday at 11 or next Wednesday at 11, I want to say thank you to Larkin Conley, Rich Logis, Mark Andel, Curtis Ellis, our engineer Henry Chaplinsky. I'm Michael Blihash. My best wishes to you and yours. May God bless you, and may God bless America.
I'm searching for an old church steeple where inside you find people who live their lives unashamed and ain't afraid to say God's name out loud.